Hey, it's Adam Carolla. You may know him from putting his body on the line in Jackass, but now Johnny Knoxville is bringing you the wildest stories from the bravest folks he knows on his newest podcast, Pretty Sure I Can Fly. With his co-host, Elna Baker, they have incredible firsthand accounts from folks who surfed 100-foot waves, ride 600 miles per hour in a rocket sled, and wrestle crocodiles just for fun. They've been talking with brave souls who throw caution to the wind and push the boundaries of what humans are capable of. Or, as Johnny would say, they're talking to people who have more balls than a bowling alley. I'm Pretty Sure I Can Fly. Johnny and Elna bring you personal stories from unsung heroes that are part comedy, part adrenaline, and all heart. These are the inspirational, hold my beer stories that will make you want to grab the bull by the horns, literally and figuratively. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly right now, early and free, right now on Wondery Plus. Well, I just want to tell you about a quick podcast study here. As you know by now, we all do our very best to align the right sponsors to the podcast. It's a lot of work behind the scenes, and I'm incredibly grateful for your support. We're currently running a quick survey at podcaststudy.com, and we're giving the first 150 people a $10 digital Amazon gift card as an incentive to complete the survey. The information we hear from you about our sponsors is incredibly important to the show, and we can't thank you enough for taking a few minutes to help us out. I mean, come on, it's free. Now cut us a break. Upon completion of the survey, you'll be asked to include your email address, and we will send the first 150 people a $10 gift card from Amazon. Go to podcaststudy.com, and thank you again for helping our show and our sponsors. Well, in the first half, Gina has some very fascinating footage about the homeless encounter she had. And Chango, Kim Kahana, 92 years young, the most fascinating life, you just listen, I think I've ever heard in my life. He'll join us. We'll do that right after this.
This is about something that lights your fire when nothing else will.
This is the Mark Divine Show. This show, we're going to discover and dive in and discuss what makes the world's most inspirational, compassionate, and resilient leaders so courageous.
Transform the nature and functioning of our own brain for the better.
Go put your virtues in action. Be the best version of yourself.
Life is a practice. Day by day, get wiser and stronger and grow.
How do you understand enough about your own mind and psychology and emotions, and how do you develop a reflective awareness practice to actually get in the driver's seat of your own mind?
We go in-depth with people from all walks of life. Martial arts grandmasters, meditative monks, CEOs, military leaders, stoic philosophers, proud survivors, and more. Every episode turns our guest experience into actionable insights that you can learn from to lead a life filled with compassion and courage.
I started putting all these little tools in my pocket, started to reflect a lot and meditate.
There has to be a balance between movement and rest.
It all starts with us. We cultivate these qualities in ourselves to become a beacon of light for others in the world. Please join us on the journey. The Mark Divine Show. Hoo-yah.
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Dominic Monaghan, and stuntman Kim Kahana Sr. With Gina Grad on news and Bald Brian on sound effects, and now, the migrants DeSantis flew to Martha's Vineyard have now been on more private planes than his entire family. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. The choice we're going to mandate, you get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend, right? Gina Grad.
That's right.
And Bald Brian.
Guys, country music is amazing.
But, Dad, it's smoky. I always suspected they were actors. I did an infomercial.
What?
But
Pocket Fisherman.
It was one of my first paid comedic gigs. I was audience warm up for an infomercial.
Wow.
That's way more respectable than being in the infomercial.
I was gonna say those go on for like half an hour, right?
The
I mean the final product.
Bob Eubanks was the host.
What was he hawking?
The game show host.
Yeah.
Bob Eubanks, sort of the last real white guy on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he was a white mm-hmm. guy. Bob Eubanks, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? He just looked the part. Did he do the Match Game? No, he did Hollywood Squares. He did
a Bachelor Line.
He did a big one.
Let's Make a Deal.
But no, it was one of the ones where Dating Newlywed. Game, the Newlywed Game.
Yeah, that's the famous In the Butt, Bob.
Yeah, in the butt.
Yeah, where's the most uncomfortable place or crazy
strangest place?
Yeah, you've had sex, and she said, In the Butt, Bob.
Yeah. He was a delight. Went out to lunch with him.
Wow.
The infomercial was for this hand cream that repelled oils and stains and odors.
So for what purpose?
So
who'd be the most interested in this?
Everybody. There were surgical gloves have been around for a long time, but nobody thought, well, wouldn't a mechanic working at an oil change place like benefit from putting on the same gloves that the surgeon is putting on, or the guy who's doing prep work in the kitchen or something like that? They never left the OR.
Right.
They just were there.
God forbid you use these things at work for other applications.
Yeah. Now it's commonplace to go behind the scenes at a mechanic shop or a butcher or something like that. It's the guy's wearing the gloves,
right.
You know. We weren't able to figure out how to get the gloves outside of the hospital.
Oh, wow.
So we needed other means for transmission fluid not to stain your cuticles.
Wow.
And that was this magical hand cream that you'd mix up. And then, you know, you'd slice and dice an onion and then force the person to smell your hand. And they go, no onion odor whatsoever.
I'm not uninterested in this product. I just want to know who it was for.
I can't think of the
name. It caused mass tumors.
Can't think of a name of it. But anyway, on happier news, Chongo, 92 years young, maybe 93
Chongo.
Years young, is going to join us that we discovered from Danger Island.
We don't want any more guests under 90.
Yes. The Danger Island was the interstitial with the banana splits and Jan Michael Vincent, one of his first roles. And directed by
Edgar Wright?
No. Oh,
who did you say? I mean, I don't know why that name popped in my head.
It was a famous director.
Sorry, which movie?
No.
The Interstitial or the
Richard Donner. He did Superman.
We talked
Goonies.
About it.
Sorry, I was glancing at Dominic Monaghan's.
I looked to you, Brian.
I know. I'm sorry. I for a second I looked at another bio.
And then the call, "Uh-oh, Chongo," would go out.
How does it go?
Uh-oh, Chongo, and. So the way it would work is if we'll play a little bit of Uh-Oh, Chongo, the actual Chongo was the most interesting, could be the most interesting man, certainly most interesting bio I've ever read in my life. But here it is.
Morgan, do you have any ideas about how to get out of this one?
Oh, yes. I wish Uh-Oh, Chongo was here.
You just yell, uh-oh, Chongo, like the Candyman or something, and they show up.
They're being surrounded by painted-faced natives, and they're probably going to be on the menu tonight, and all you do is scream, uh-oh, Chongo.
And he comes sliding in on a zip line.
Got it.
And he was a stuntman, and he spoke gibberish in Danger Island.
Right.
But Dawson has his bio, and his bio is insane. Now, look, when you get to 92, you've usually done a couple of things in your life, but this guy started early.
He dropped out of school in third grade, then at 9 tried to stow away on a ship headed for San Francisco. He was found and sent back.
In Hawaii. He was in Hawaii,
I think, when he started. Witnessed Pearl Harbor at the age of 11. After that, tried again to stow away on another ship headed for San Francisco. This time he was successful. And then at age 13, he hitchhiked across the U.S. alone, sometimes stealing to eat. He began performing as a knife and fire dancer in a stage show and served as a paratrooper in the Korean conflict.
Sure.
Damn.
He was captured, shot down by an enemy firing squad. He faked his death and was left for dead in a mass grave.
Jesus.
He is permanently blind in his left eye from a hand grenade explosion. He's got a silver star, two bronze stars, and two purple hearts.
Wow.
Then he survived a plane crash in Texas that killed 32 other people.
That's right.
Of course.
And then he started working as an extra in film, became a stunt performer for better pay. At one point, he was the highest paid stunt, one of the highest paid stunt people in the business. And then he played Chongo on Dead and Danger Island.
Yeah. That's when he walked into my life. Yeah. Actually slid into it on a rope.
Swung in.
I wonder what his parents' story is, if he's trying to stow away at 9 years old and
people
11 years old.
Didn't care about their kids nearly as much
as precious, we do
today.
But did they notice? He's on a steamboat headed for the mainland?
He did stunts in Cool Hand Luke, Planet of the Apes, Shay, Patton, The Omega Man, Joe Kidd, Soylent Green, and the Smokey and the Bandit franchise.
Oh, yeah.
And because of his size, he could play women, too, right?
Yeah, he did Sally Fields Flying Nun.
Sure.
Because she had to fly, but Sally wasn't going to do that.
Right.
So Chongo was called. So for me, Uh-Oh Chongo is if you're standing in line at the cafeteria in the fifth grade and somebody dropped their tray of slop, you would then yell, Uh-Oh Chongo, to alert all the other kids to make fun of the kid that knocked the tray over.
And it goes without saying they all understood what you were saying.
Everyone understood Uh-Oh Chongo, so much so that there's a song called Uh-Oh Chongo.
Sure.
That was written lest you guys think that I'm just kind of pulling this stuff out of my ass.
Yeah.
This is woven into the fabric of America.
Oh, boy.
That's hey, Chris. Not a bad tune.
Uh-oh, Chongo! Uh-oh, Chongo!
Hey, Chris.
He lives on 9 and what do you know? Lots of high school left to know.
A full 20 years after that show was on. It burned some punk rocker's mind.
Sort of lo-fi K-rock vibe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to know any more about the song, but I feel like we need to know. Who's that by? When was it?
The Lizards.
Okay.
1995, although I was told 96 in the other room.
Out. Well, it charted in late 95 and went on, you know, through the summer.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know who the Lizards are, but... Big Danger Island fans, evidently.
You know, this is good because, you know, like, you don't want your kid to swear and you don't want them to get in a habit. And you, like, we come up with, like, a crazy word instead of, you know, going, ah, fuck, in front of the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you spill something, I'm going to introduce
Chongo.
Chongo. My guess is
Chongo.
The Lizards had to have been foreign, Australian or British or something. Mm. And this bizarre concoction only made it to their land many years later. Because why would someone in the 90s, presumably in their 20s, in a band, give a shit? Even know who Chongo is. Mm. I learned of him yesterday.
Why do you hate them so much?
Who?
The Lizards
and
Chongo.
No, I'm saying there's no way they could have had nostalgia as a 20-year-old for something that happened in 1970, 69.
Chongo also did work in TV, did Mission Impossible. He did The $6 Million Man, one of the greatest parts of my childhood. Vegas, Magnum P.I., Charlie's Angels, Quincy, Fantasy Island.
Oh, my God.
The Brady Bunch.
What? Where? When? What? They go to Hawaii?
Oh, ooh. Obviously.
I'd be curious.
It was like a three-parter with the tiki and the little totem.
Oh, like MacArthur returning to the Philippines.
That's right. Chongo stows away, this time first class Pan Am.
That's right.
With Robert Reed by his side.
That's right.
Yeah, so he is he 92 or 93? Am I screwing that up? Chris will tell me, but
92. It says 92 on the
92. So we'll talk to him. Do you have any more on him, Dawson? Sorry,
no, that covered it. You got it from the TV was just the wrap of it.
Yeah. Now he's in Florida doing a stunt school.
Yeah,
in Florida.
It also says that he has 6 black belts in karate, aikido, and jujitsu, and he broke his bones more than 60 times.
That's
doing
what
stunts.
I was looking for. Yeah. Crazy.
Insane.
And still here, everyone. And complete bygone era, the stowing away on ships, the hitchhiking across America, the sort of walking onto film sets and finding work. It's all done away with, yep. Oh, you got to be in the union, and there's no more of this. No more by the seat of your pants.
An irreplaceable anything. Part of the show, I'm guessing. Who else could you get to play Chongo?
Yeah.
You know, if he was like, I want more money. Okay. Otherwise, we have that character's gone.
All right. Gina, you got some homeless vid you wanted to share with us?
I've been thinking a lot about the true face of homelessness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I live in the Valley, and I know that up until very recently, our governor has said that it's a woman with three kids, and I'm looking for her. I look for her every day. I look high and low. I look on the off-way ramps. I look everywhere, and I haven't found the elusive mom with the three kids.
By the way, as Drew always points out, we have plenty of places for that woman to go.
Right.
If she exists on the street with her three kids, she would be welcome into many shelters.
Yes.
And she would be taken care of.
The only exception is the family that parks themselves by like the Target with the sign, and then the dad comes and picks them up. That's a mm-hmm. totally different horse of a different color. But I go to this very lovely dog park every day because we're puppy sitting. And everyone's super cool.
It's the loneliest story if you had no dog.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it's awesome. You can go any hour of the day. We do something that I like to call doggy disco at the end of the day where everyone gets glow sticks. It's great. And take the kid. And great time. Upstanding community. Great dogs. But yesterday, trouble was afoot.
Uh-oh.
Chongo. So everyone's playing with their dogs and having a gay old time. And then we just hear this fucking scream, wild screaming next to the park. So that was the first clip I sent you, Ben. Let's see if you can hear this guy. The dogs are starting to get upset. They're going crazy. Oh, he's just singing here.
You're singing.
Screaming, singing so loud, walking around. All the dogs are upset. All the dogs have left their post. I'm like, okay, whatever. Guys is walking around. There's two porta potties out there, whatever.
What godforsaken part of town is this?
How dare you? Deep Valley.
Okay.
So whatever. Then he comes in and he takes a shine to my little pup. So I'm real close by. I'm sitting right there. And I thought, you know, he's a nonstop monologue. Let's just get a clip for the show. So this is one of the many things he was saying.
Remember, have you seen the Green Mile?
He's talking to the dogs.
He's sitting alone on the bench?
Talking to God knows who.
I love that guy. He's so fucking funny, dude. He's like, before.
This is Michael Clark Duncan impression.
Is there a chance he's talking to someone with those earbuds?
I'm the only one there. No, because that's music. He's screaming along to it. He takes whatever's in his bottle and starts dumping it around the dogs. And I was like, hey. He's like, oh no, it's salt water. It's great. You could freeze salt water and drink it. I'm like, I'm going to talk to Vinny about that. So apparently this is also just a wonderful place for people to come on up and go insane.
Yeah, the thing is, nobody wants to be the person that walks on the other side of the street. But on the other hand, with so many just nutty, volatile, who knows what could happen, people just wandering, circumnavigating the neighborhoods, like, yeah, we're freaked out. There's been too many cases of them punching people or pushing them in front of trains or whatever it is.
And that's the thing. I mean, it's like he's... You know how violence has this new umbrella that it means so many things? Mm-hmm. But so does harmless. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, oh, he's harmless. I'm like, I don't know. He's kind of fucking with the dog I'm dog sitting.
And he's harmless until he's not.
Right. It seems erratic.
Which is going to take less than 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Right. But he did get up in Riverdance, which was awesome. He was singing a song about Jesus. He was listening to Christian rock. He got up and started like hop dancing and river dancing.
Nice.
That was fucking awesome. And then I said, you know what? I don't want to chance this. And we left.
Quit while you're ahead.
That's right. So, you know, mom and three kids, haven't seen her. Seen more of this guy.
Yeah, that's all there is. Yeah. Who else would sleep on pavement? Mm. That's all. Mm. That's all you need to know. And also, everyone you know would have access to somebody's sofa if they weren't junkies and they hadn't worn out their welcome.
Right.
There's the concept of you having your wits about you and not being addicted and calling any family member or any friend and saying, hey, man, I'm out of money. Can I crash in your pool house or on a futon or an inflatable mattress in your garage? There's nobody who wouldn't get that invitation.
Yes. And just to add a little sweetener on it, he asked us, which was very nice. I mean, technically he asked my dog, but I was standing there, if he was allowed to smoke weed. He pulls out a vape pen.
What did the dog say?
The dog was fucking down. He pulls out a vape pen, starts inhaling like a motherfucker, and telling the two dogs that were sitting in front of him that he got a great deal on this. So I understand self-medicating. I understand that people do it. But, like, somebody please help this person. Because this is, he doesn't belong in the dog park talking to dogs.
So speaking of homicidal maniacs, I interviewed Detective Paul Holes on Take a Knee.
What?
Yeah.
I love Paul Holes.
I knew you'd know.
Do you know there's a whole – there's a whole hashtag campaign called Hot for Holes because girls love Paul Holes.
Who is this man?
Explain.
He's a cold case detective. Easy on the eyes. He was one of the guys, or maybe the guy from the Golden State Killer, the guy who...
Oh, like when the case re-entered the sort
yeah.
of...
Yeah, with yes. Patton Oswalt's wife. And...
Yes.
He was that guy, but he works on many cold cases. They had a discussion with him about sort of the serial killing and like where it is. You know what I mean? Like now, it's kind of interesting. I have a clip.
Please.
It's very, I mean, the Golden State Killer, this guy was, man. I'll play a couple of clips. Who's the worst of the worst that maybe we've never heard of? Some of these guys have better publicists than others. They get sort of sexy names and Night Stalker and Hillside Strangler and stuff like that. And you've heard of them, but in terms of body count, damage, you know, it may be in the middle somewhere, but then there's other guys. Like I was heard some guy out of Russia that killed, you know, I don't know, 80 people or something like that. And then there's the way they do it and who their, right. who their victims are and the age of their victims and things like that. But who pops to mind as sort of the worst?
You know, that's such a hard question for me to answer because of all the various variables involved. You know, when you talk about the sheer numbers of victims, somebody like a Sam Little who was preying, you know, he's basically moving around the nation, going into the underbellies of various jurisdictions and luring, you know, drug addicted sex workers in essence and killing them. And
what years was he active?
Geez, he was active, I believe, as early as in the 70s up into through the 90s. And, you know, is literally going back and forth between Florida, California, up into the, you know, northern part of the Midwest. And he's got over 90 plus victims.
Really?
And I think, you know, 45 have been confirmed, you know, but he admitted to many more. And the people that are involved with investigating him believe that he's being honest about, you know, the number of victims that he had.
Yeah, because there's the guys you've heard of, but they got 9 victims or 13 victims. And then there's a bunch of guys in the 80s. Right. And over 100 with some people.
Yeah, or they'll say like, well, he's admitting to 20, so you can multiply that by however many.
Yeah, then we...
Charles Manson, the scariest dude of the decade right. of the century, five victims, sold right. the baby too.
Right. We also then start getting into the Golden State Killer, and I didn't know he called his victims.
I didn't know that.
Because he did a lot of just raping.
And but like fucking with them afterwards, you mean, or like? No, well, maybe he'll tell us.
Saying sorry. And
oh my god!
No, he's fucking with them. Yes, right. Calling, torturing them.
I mean, but I mean, before or after, like leading up to it, or like
sometimes
during
24 years after.
Jesus.
When he was on the lam.
When these women, the life is finally on track, and they can put this behind them.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God.
I'll play the second clip about him terrorizing people long after he was a cop, the ex-cop, and he would break into people's houses, and he would kill a lot of them, but some he would just rape, I think. There had to be a part of him that sort of knew this must be looming somewhere. But
no, I guarantee he was following his case, you know, through the years in the newspapers. In fact, after a DNA link to Southern California cases in 2001 was made, he called up a victim that he attacked in 1977, you know, the 2 days later after the Sacramento Bee published a newspaper article. So he was following the case. And I guarantee, you know, through online resources, he's following the case. I believe he was constantly looking over his shoulder. In fact, when he was under surveillance, he did, you know, what Ken Clark called a gypsy run, where he gets up, you know, onto the freeway in his car and is doing counter surveillance moves as he drives to the airport, pulls off to the side of the airport before he's committed to have to go to the terminal. And everybody who's following him from law enforcement in pursuit has to pass him by not to burn the surveillance. Right. And then he just flips around and drives back home. And they backed off surveillance thinking, oh no, we've been made, you know, and we don't know, did he hink up because he saw some strange car or some strange, you know, undercover guy in the neighborhood? Or is this something that he did routinely because he was so paranoid? It's possible both, you know, you just don't know.
He called a victim. What motivated that? I mean, I know there was a story that motivated it, but what was he trying to get from that phone call?
Well, this is what he was doing back in the 70s. We actually have a tape recording of him calling his very first victim up in Sacramento, you know, doing basically what it almost sounds like, you know, the teenage boy, you know, heavy breathing. But then he starts in this tape recording. He raped her in June of 76. He calls her in January of 78, a year and a half later. But ultimately is through clenched teeth, he's telling this woman, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. And this is what he was about. He's a psychological sadist. He loved inflicting fear. And so he was calling many of his victims back in the day. This particular case, 24 years after he attacked this woman, and now he's known what he was known as East Area Rapist in Sacramento back in the 70s. Well, once DNA, and I was the one that did this, linked him to the original Night Stalker homicides in Southern California, and the Sacramento Bee put a newspaper article out there. He called this woman 24 years later to let her know he was still around. And when he called her, what he said to her, all he said was, remember when we played?
Oh.
Of course, she freaked out. But that's what he got off on. This is part of his fantasy. He loved that psychological terror.
Well, there you go, Gina.
I would, the second I got that call, I would go, okay, hang up, change my name, get a new identity, and fucking move. I mean, if he knows your phone number, assuming he's calling a home phone, then you're a sitting duck and you have to leave your life behind. That's horrifying.
Oh, God. I always feel bad for the husband, too. We got to move. It's Monday Night Football's tonight.
Nope. We've been made.
I'll get a deadbolt for the front door.
You do understand that this person raped and tried to kill me 2 decades ago, yes?
2 decades ago.
But you he still has our phone number.
You said it yourself. I've seen composites of the guy. He's not bad looking.
Mommy, Daddy, who is on the phone?
Get your suitcase.
Your Uncle Stu.
Oh, anything you can pack, put in there.
I want to borrow more money.
Oh, our uncle's coming over. I got to pack something.
I know you're in your pajamas, but get your boots.
I'm
put them
tired.
On.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
You can sleep in
can
the car.
Can I sleep with the window open?
We'll sleep all night long in the car. No!
Son, you're taking statistics at school, right?
Yeah, very advanced.
What are the chances of the same unicorn being raped? Being mounted twice by the same. Shit. Help me out here.
You're going to get raped. Get in the car.
Wait, I'm so this must be a dream.
Oh, God. Fuck. 24 years later, your phone rings.
Nope. Not interested in that.
Jesus Christ. At some point, I could only imagine a worst person on the planet. And then guys like Detective Paul. I mean, there's one of those. There's 100 of those guys for every fucking nut job serial killer.
True. And wasn't – you guys might have gotten into it, but wasn't he ultimately found out and essentially caught because like a distant cousin did a DNA test?
I thought that it was in my memory and many people's memory that somebody outed him like the Unabomber, like from a – from a family member sort of outed him.
Right.
But he...
I thought that was Hal.
He did find the distant cousin in one of those 23andMe whatevers. But it wasn't because the person came forward.
Oh, it was just banked in the 23andMe.
It was just banked. They just look at all those databases, and that's what happened. All right. Kim Kahana.
All right.
92 years young, in from Florida. We're going to talk to him in a second. First, I'll tell you about Concrete. Your body makes half the creatine it needs. The other half comes from your diet, but most American diets are low in creatine-rich foods. Concrete patented creatine, HCL, is the favorite creatine of elite, well-informed athletes. I take this stuff every day. Dr. Drew does as well. It's the number one bioavailable creatine. It's the only microdosing creatine. Just one small scoop per 100 pounds of your body weight. Shake it up. It's got a nice lemony flavor to it. And you immediately feel the energy kick in. Try it. You'll see what I'm talking about. Creatine is required for functional energy in every cell in your body. And your brain uses about 20% of the creatine in your body. So let's keep it going with Concrete, right, Dawson?
Take control of your health, both body and mind. Build a better you with Concrete. Register now at con-crete.com/podcast. That's con-crete.com/podcast for a chance to win a $500 Walmart Visa gift card. Available now online and in-store. Walmart Concrete is truly life-changing and performance-enhancing.
Well, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to the stunt performer and the veteran and Chungo, Kim Kahana, right after this.
You own, do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Ace man, Ryan from Wisconsin. Tip for all the guys out there. When you go to the titty bar, keep your singles in a different pocket from the rest of your money. Gave a chick $100, and I didn't realize it until after she walked away. Guess it was her fucking lucky night. Get it on.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, Kim Kahana, stuntman, actor, veteran, is on Zoom, coming in from Florida. Good to meet you, Mr. Kahana.
Well, thank you.
So I was just reminiscing with Sid Croft about Danger Island in the studio a couple of days ago, and then I yelled, uh-oh, Chungo, and then I started thinking about you and Jan Michael Vincent back in the day and Danger Island, and then we started looking into your life, and it turned out to be fascinating. So how did the whole Danger Island thing come about for you?
I was working on a set with Gregory Peck and got an audition to go in and do a backflip. They wanted a backflip on Chungo, and I had no idea what this was about. So I didn't go in, because when you're working, you want that job. You don't want to go in for an interview. So I waited a couple of days, and I had a friend of mine that was a stuntman too, and at lunchtime, he took me into the studio, Hanna-Barbera, for the interview. And I went in, and they gave me a script, and I'm not good at reading, and reading scripts and things. So what I did was I jumped on his desk and threw the script up in the air and did a backflip off and said thank you and walked out. And the next day I got called and I got the part.
Where did you film Danger Island?
Mexico, Acapulco, and Mexico City.
And Richard Donner was the director?
Richard Donner was the director. I met him. He liked me. We got along fine. And he kind of let me have the reins to do anything I wanted on it.
And you worked, of course, with a young Jan Michael Vincent before he really turned into, he was a Hollywood leading man hunk a couple of years later, right?
Yes, he was a very close friend.
What kind of guy was he? Because I don't think any, I don't know.
A gullible guy. He lived in Malibu, had horses. He got married on the set. He was just a gullible guy. The only thing is he did a lot of drugs and drinking.
On the set.
It did. You're born in Hawaii. You witnessed Pearl Harbor?
Yes.
Where were you when Pearl Harbor, when the attack hit?
I was in Pearl City. I lived in Pearl City, and I could see the whole dock. Wow. But I didn't know it was a bombing because it was in the morning, and us kids go to catechism and church. So when we heard all the noise and everything, we didn't know it was a bombing. We just went out, and then when you see fires and all the shooting, then we knew something was going on.
And so you stowed away on a ship and came to the mainland. Where were your parents during this whole ordeal?
Well, I never had a mother. I never knew my mother. I didn't know if I had any sisters or brothers. And my father was in the Coast Guard, and he was always out to sea or traveling. So I was raised by titas, what we call uncle and auntie in Hawaii. We call them titas. And that's how I grew up on my own, basically.
And so you got to the mainland, to San Francisco, I guess, when you're 13?
Yeah.
And did you know anybody? Did you have a plan, a place, anything?
No, I had a plan. I had... my father had told me about an uncle of mine, he called him an uncle, that lived in New York. And he played in a big, big band with Xavier Coogan. And so my plan was to get to the mainland and then to get to New York somehow and find him, which I did.
Wow.
And so... did you have any money or any provisions at all?
No. I would go to farms and I would steal out of food bins. I would knock on windows when I would see people eating in restaurants, work on farms, chopping wood, doing something just to get food.
And how long did it take you to hitchhike to New York?
I think it took me about 4 weeks. I took trains. I rode trains. I learned how to catch trains with the bums and work with them and live with them, basically.
He's 13 at this point.
Yeah.
13.
Put in perspective.
Are we talking about 1941, 42, somewhere around there?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So you get to New York, and how do you run this uncle down?
I tried to find out the big bands and the big names, and I got names of certain people and this thing. So I would go to the stages and ask questions, and I had a little stagehand tell me about Kuga and about the people in it. And I waited there all night until all the band people came out. And I saw this little guy that was Filipino, and I went over to him and asked him about things. And he told me, yes, he knew my father and stuff like that. And I stayed with him for, probably about 6 months.
And was there any, like, when you got to New York, because it's a question that's ongoing now, were there services, were there places you could go, were there soup kitchens and
outreach?
Outreach?
No. Well, I never knew about homeless people. I never knew you could even do that. I would beg on the streets and get money, and people would help me. There have been a lot of people that would just come over and buy you something, a hamburger or something.
And so then after 6 months of staying with the uncle, now you're the ripe old age of almost 14. It's time to strike out on your own again, or what was the plan?
Well, he taught me how to play instruments, how to play the drum and guitar. So I learned all that stuff. And I would get into little bands here and there and just make some money. And then I went back. I took a train and went back to California because my father was in California at that time, not Hawaii. He was in a different station in San Pedro.
And so you reunite with your dad. What's your dad think about your journey?
He didn't think too much about it. We never got along.
He didn't notice.
So now you make it back to California. Now we're still, World War II is still raging on at this point, right?
Right.
And what's your plan from San Pedro?
Well, I had no plan. I didn't know what to do. So my father put me into the Coast Guard. I was 16, I think.
And how do you end up in Korea?
After the Coast Guard, I got out of the Coast Guard. I was 1949, and it's going into 50, and then 50, Korea broke out. So I decided to go in the Army. So I enlisted in the Army and went to boot camp at Fort Benning and learned how to be a paratrooper.
And you end up in Korea, and then there's the part that seems insane, which is captured prisoner of war, firing squad, mass grave.
Paratrooping?
Yeah.
Well, no, we got captured. We were in a different balloon, and we went behind enemy lines, a whole skirmish of us paratroopers. That was the 187th, and got captured, and we were brought to a prison camp, and then one morning we were brought out in a truck and lined up. It was about, I don't know, maybe 200-300 of us lined up, and they had bulldozers there, and they had dug a big hole and everything. And we didn't know what was going on, but what they were going to do is they were going to kill us and bury us, which they did.
So how did that, walk us through that? I find that to be interesting.
I can't walk you through it. I kind of stayed there, and I kind of watched the person that was shooting at me, watching their finger, and when I thought he pulled the trigger, I fell into the hole with the rest of the people.
Oh, Jesus. God.
And then did they bury you guys alive, or you alive?
They buried us then, and I didn't know where I was, upside down, inside out. But I kept digging and digging, and I kept the people that were laying on me to get air pockets. And finally, it felt like 100 hours. I finally got to the top and felt air and looked out, and all these guys were drinking and laughing and giggling. And I waited there until it got dark and crawled out into the trees and forest and made it back to my company.
Oh my God.
Did anyone else make it out of the mass grave?
Not that I know to this day.
Yikes. Wow. So then Now, you got the silver star and two bronze stars and two purple hearts. I'm guessing that was one of the purple hearts, or was there something, there are two other things that happened?
One of the purple hearts, and the second thing came from a different star mission.
A different mission, did you say?
Yes.
So now you get out of the Army, and you go back where?
I was scarred up pretty bad. I got wounded pretty bad. I was blind. And they sent me to New York to get an operation. And I got an operation there. And I could see barely and went back to California to find out about where I was going to live, what I was going to do, if I was going to stay with my father, and so forth.
Jumping ahead, there's also a pretty insane story about a plane crash.
That same when I took this plane from New York, it crashed in Kellyfield, Texas, and broke apart. And I was sitting in the very back, and the front people, there was about 32 people that got killed. I broke both arms.
How many people were on the plane? Do you remember?
I don't remember. Over 100 people, I would imagine.
Wow. The plane crash and the mass grave are not too many years apart. You had to feel either lucky or super unlucky.
Final destination.
Trying to think. Did you ever?
I thought I was pretty lucky to get away from a lot of different things.
So you make it back to L.A., and when does the showbiz and the stuntman stuff start?
I get back to California, and my father says I can stay with him, but I got to get a job and everything. And when I was younger, I was doing the Samoan knife dance, fire dance, because I grew up with Hawaiians and Samoans. So I went to the Seven Seas on Hollywood Boulevard across the street from a Grumman's Chinese Theater and asked if I could get a job. And there was a man called Freddie Latulli there, and he liked me and took me in and started teaching me more. So I worked there in the nighttime, and the waiters that worked there worked in the studios as extras and asked me if I wanted to be an extra. And I said, well, what do they do? And so they took me into the studio and I saw what an extra does, and they get like $8.50 a day. And then I saw cowboys on horses that were falling off the horses getting shot. And I thought, well, how much do they get? And they get $250. Mm. And I said, well, hell, I was in Korea getting no money. So why don't I do that? So the only thing I had to do was find out how to ride a horse and get into the stunt business, which is not an easy thing to do.
By the way, I do believe the Seven Seas turned into kind of a new wave or punk nightclub in like the 80s. Wow. Because there was a Seven Seas in Hollywood when I was like 19, and it was a hangout. Like I think it was still going strong into the 80s. Probably this took on a new motif.
This is Chongo's table, they would say.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So you start getting into stunting. Did you come across Hal Needham or?
No, I didn't know what to do because you had to know how to ride a horse. So I wanted to find out who the top stuntmen were, and their names was the Eppers family, Johnny Eppers and his family, and Yakima Knut. They were the two top leading stunt guys in the stunt business. So I found out where they live, knocked on the door, and asked them to teach me. And Johnny Yeppers said, fine, but you have to learn how to take care of the animals first. So I would go in the mornings and clean up horse manure, feed the horses, and he would teach me how to ride horses and how to groom them, take care of them. This took months at a time. First movie I ever worked on, they took me into the movies.
Yakima Canuck or Canup was a famous stunt guy.
I know the name.
Yeah, Yakima Canuck was one of the most famous, and Johnny Yeppers and the Yeppers family.
Yakima, they were the top. So he lived in North Hollywood, California. And he
lived in Chatsworth, California.
Oh, well, then they moved. Neighbors. They moved from Chatsworth to North Hollywood at some point.
He died in North Hollywood.
Died in North Hollywood. Yeah. That's where he was. He 86. Was on the corner by my house. He was a grandfather of one of the kids I knew. And it was like, Yakima's house is there. And we didn't, you know, he...
Yeah, Yakima was the only stuntman to get an Oscar for Ben-Hur.
Wow.
He did this... pioneered this move. I don't know what he called it, but he got on the front. He jumped from horse to horse to horse and and go forward. Yeah. And when the wagon train got out of, I don't know.
He made a lot of stunt equipment for the stunt men. And we still use that equipment today.
And it is interesting. There was, and maybe still is, a stunt school in Chatsworth, California, because...
That was mine.
That was yours?
Oh, my God.
That was mine. I opened the first stunt school in the world, and the stunt people didn't like it.
Oh, so that was your place in off of, I don't know, Owen's Mouth or something?
Yeah, Devon's Mouth. I lived on Owen's Mouth, and my school...
You lived on Owen's Mouth! I knew it.
That's my school.
Oh my God.
That's so crazy. So I used to work at a cabinet shop in Owen's Mouth. And then there's this, I don't think people realize that even through the 80s, there were big, vast, vacant lots and land, like Chatsworth. People had horses. It was, it was well into the 80s that people had horses and land and stuff. And there was a stunt school. And my boss, Tommy, lived the cabinet shop was off of Owen's Mouth in deep Chatsworth. And I used to drive home and I'd look at the stunt school because they had a tower. Yeah. Guys had like a fall tower in the back. And I'd just kind of go, I wonder if I could do a stunt or something.
I'm shocked you didn't pull in one day and see what's what.
Well, I'm guessing they were charging and I didn't have any money. True. But
knocks on the door and Chongo opens the
that
door.
That was your stunt school on Owen's Mouth.
Yeah. That was mine, yeah.
Wow.
That was one of the first ones that were opened.
God. And I guess the stuntmen didn't like it because you were graduating a lot of people into their community?
Well, no, the stunt business is handed down from father to son to daughter, and they have secrets that they don't want other people to teach.
Mm.
My idea was not to give the secrets, but to teach them safety and how you could be more safe, because we had no safety rule.
Yeah, it was like it's like magicians being like, I don't know about this magic class.
Right.
Were you?
And after a while, after about 3 years of working, the stunt community came back, and now we have stunt schools all over the world, and a lot of them are scams.
Did you have a special gag that you were known for, like being lit on fire or high falls or horses?
I did tricks with motorcycles.
Oh, this is getting even better.
Nice.
Yeah, I did a lot of tricks with motorcycles. Rode barrels, jumped them. I did crazy things, which you wouldn't do today.
So you were like in Omega Man. I think at some point he got on a motorcycle.
Yes.
Heston did.
It's on his CV here, Omega Man.
Oh, yeah.
He worked on the movie.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that.
It's all right. I'm good, but I'm not that good. But you, although there is the Owen's Mouth. Kismet.
That was good.
So you did motorcycles was kind of your specialty.
Yeah, it was my specialty. But I learned from other stunt guys how to do fire gags, high falls. I was always a guy that did high diving. I did for Elvis Presley, fun in Acapulco, I did the dive off of the cliff.
That used to be a big deal, the cliff divers of Acapulco. I mean, Wide World of Sports would cover it.
As they should. It's cool.
I would watch it, and it was always crazy because of how close it would come to the rocks. Yeah. And
well, the water would come in, and you would only have 6 feet to get into.
Yeah, that seemed like the scary part. Any good stories about, I don't know, breaking bones or crashing motorcycles?
Well, I have broken about 60 bones in my life. I mean, I broke my back twice, one on Death Hunt with Charles Bronson. I used to double John Bronson for about 20 years, so I got hurt a couple times with him. And my arms, legs, collarbone, everything's been shattered somehow. mainly because of me, because I was too stubborn to listen.
Yeah, so stunts have come a long way. They're a lot safer now, a lot more regulated.
Well, believe it or not, we have more people, more young kids getting killed today than we did before.
Really?
Because the kids are only thinking about money today. They're not thinking about their job.
But stunts in movies or stunts of guys trying to do crazy stuff on BMX bikes?
No, stunts in movies.
Really?
Oh, my God.
Stunts and movies. We just had two guys, a woman, a girl, and a boy last year got killed, one on a high fall, one on a motorcycle.
Wow.
What is the craziest stunt you've seen? Like, first off, they had a movie called Stuntman, but they did a movie called Hooper, and I think Jan Michael Vincent. You had to work at Hooper. He did a fall off a helicopter ski into an airbag. I mean,
what?
I don't know. You were there.
I did Hooper, but the scariest thing I ever did was going from one airplane to another airplane about 10,000 feet without no parachute.
Wow.
The James Bond movie?
What movie was that?
Airport 75.
What kind of airplane?
It was a DC. It was from a military helicopter to a DC. The idea was the pilot got sick and passed out, so they had to get a pilot to land the plane. So they transferred them from one airplane to the other airplane.
Yeah, the airport series, which gave way to the airplane series, yeah. There was a 75, a 76. There was one with the Concorde.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So what'd you do on Hooper?
Hooper, we did car stunts. We must have had maybe 200 brand new Trans Ams. And we crashed them like crazy. Everything was a big crash.
Hooper is worth a watch because Jan Michael Vincent's at the height of his powers. Burt Reynolds is as Burt Reynolds-y as he's ever been.
The height of his Burt Reynolds-ness.
It's funny. There's a lot of laughs in it and crazy stunts and analog stunts.
Yeah, here on Wikipedia it says the film serves as a tribute to stuntmen and stuntwomen in what was once an unrecognized profession. So this is like a love letter to the stunt community.
They took down a whole old smokestack and timed it the car sped just underneath it as this giant brick smokestack was falling down. They jumped the car over a ravine like 300 feet with a jet with a rocket on it.
Hal Needham was in charge of that.
Yeah, Hal Needham was the guy who, stunt guy, who then kind of wrote those movies, but they weren't really scripted completely.
Just a sketch.
He was a friend of Bert's, and they lived together. And when you were doing stunts in those days and lived with the star and everything, you just became one of them.
What do you think about Tom Cruise doing so many of his own stunts?
I think he's a nutcase.
Yes, go ahead, Brian.
Well, you, Mr. Khanna, alluded to it, but have you noticed, speaking of Tom Cruise and his crazy stunts, have you noticed a sort of swing back towards practical stunts from CGI? It feels to me like there's so much more now that's real on the screen.
Oh, yeah. There's too many CGI stunts, and people don't know the difference.
Right.
You know, with the green screens and everything, it's taken away from the stunt community.
I'm going to take another deep dive. Maybe it's a Florida thing. Maybe it's just an era thing. Do you know the detective J.J. Arms?
No.
Oh, damn.
Damn it.
We're on a roll there.
He was a private detective who lost his hands and had different attachments on it. There was a whole action figure about it. Super 70s.
But a real guy.
A real guy,
yeah.
Who's still alive, I think, and whose name is J.J. Arms, that even is. Though he blew his hands off.
Connie wasn't J.J. Balls.
Yes. What a crazy journey. What a crazy story. I'm looking. You have a book out, right? Khanna, The Untold Stories?
Yes, there is a book out.
And you can find it wherever you find finer books.
Amazon
as well. Who list some of the notables you've worked with over your career.
Oh, God. John Wayne. You could sit down with John Wayne and have a beer. Walt Disney.
Oh, my.
Would bring out lunch to us. James Gardner. I mean, just tons and tons of good people.
You can definitely stop after John Wayne and Walt Disney. Yeah, it's not going to get better than that.
It's
Paul Newman. Paul Newman was a great guy.
What'd you work with Newman?
Cool Hand Luke. You see me putting the egg in his mouth.
Oh, my God.
That's you.
It's like the famous scene.
Huh? My God.
He was a great guy. He would make a bar in his station wagon for the stunt guys. And after we would wrap, we would all have a couple of drinks. And, I mean, some of your stars were great, too. Like Burt Reynolds and those guys. They took good care of some people.
What a crazy life. I'm so glad we went down your rabbit hole because a few days ago I was just talking about Uh-Oh, Chungo. And next thing you know, here we are. Between you and Sid Croft of Sid and Marty Croft combined, it's got a tough argument to figure out who's had a more complex, interesting life. I'll give the nod to you because you were buried alive in Korea.
Tips him over the edge.
Yeah, and the plane crash as well. Kim Khanna, thank you so much for joining us. The school, Khanna's Stunt and Film Schools in Florida. You can visit their Facebook page to learn more. And I'm glad to hear that after all these years, Chungo's still going strong.
Well, they're still doing a documentary on me, and it probably won't be edited until next year, in January or so.
When it comes
out, come back. I will watch the hell out of that.
And just for anyone who can't see right now, you're sitting in an incredible room with like katana swords and badass stuff. So that's amazing.
Oh, it's like a museum here. All pictures on the wall of all your stars and everything else I've done.
Kim Khanna, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir.
Oh, man.
Awesome.
I got to tell you, between him and Sid Croft,
Lord.
Living legends.
When you talk to someone in their 90s, you worry a little bit that some of the thoughts and the forms of the words and the things may not come sailing out.
He's a sharp 92-ish year old.
I want you to just marinate on this because I don't think it's fair to put you on the spot. But who do you think's had a more exciting life? Sid Croft, Kim Kahana, or Jim Carolla?
Well, that's...
You think about it.
Flip the coin. I'll be in the next room awaiting the results.
We all win either way.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And it's also... I don't think people like our children will be capable of having these kind of lives because the way the world is they'll go, I had an idea to open a stunt school in Chatsworth. And 4 years later, I got a permit. But they still had to do a soils report. And then there's an environmental impact report. So everything's just been slowed down.
And their outlets were too high up on the wall.
Yes, everything just takes so long that you can only squeeze in so much into a life. Yeah. Like if you just go, I built a big custom castle in Malibu. Well, you could do that in 3 years or you could be doing it in 26 years now because of the Coastal Commission. Yeah, you know what I mean? Right. So everything has been so fucking regulated that you couldn't just walk onto sets and you couldn't just do things.
Ask for a job. I also think I'm assuming that the friendly hobo is a bygone era.
Yeah,
the train hopping hobo.
You're 100% right. There are so many elements of a story that were anachronistic. Like, oh, this would never, couldn't just show up in New York for. I think I have an uncle out there.
But he did give me a lot of hope when I'm like, oh, I could never do that. Oh, it was easy. All I had to do was somehow cross the country with no money,
learn the guitar,
find out this guy that my dad knew, and track him down.
Yeah.
Or all I had to do was go find the two families that teach. That do stunts and have to teach me.
It's crazy that his stunt school was off of Owen's Mouth, and I used to look at it when I was 25.
That was my school, he said.
Dominic Monaghan is going to join us. Another great Raccoon tour, and we'll bring him in right after this.
Saddle up and get ready for Westerns Weeks on Pluto TV, all for free. We're coming in blazing with favorites like True Grit and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Or immerse yourself in binge-worthy series like Yellowstone and Walker, Texas Ranger. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies, TV shows, and more. The best part? It's free. No credit card, no sign-up, no fees. Download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now.